Oh, John, sorry, and John Moreland is. Good.
You bet. Thank you.
I think, yeah, there we go.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bruce. And we're going to do something a little bit different here, but I think that would be okay with Bert in terms of challenging not just having one person talk, but we're going to do a team talk. And I'm Claudia Wagner-Riddle, and I did a postdoc with George some years ago, and I think this is where one of the connections that we'll talk about. So the connections with Guelph, or the Tanner-Thurtell connection, goes back a long way. Back in the 1960s, as Bruce mentioned, George took his family, wife, and I don't remember how many children at the time, if any, but soon there came three, and to do his PhD at Madison with Champ Tanner. So you may have seen some of these pictures before at the different tributes. One of the top ones I got from Ken King, showing Champ Tanner during field campaign down in Davis, and the leftmost person on the other picture is George, and I think Marv Wesley and Andy Black. Some later years, when Champ Tanner was visiting the Thurtells, and that tells you where about in the globe Guelph is, about halfway between the equator and the North Pole. This connection continued for many years, and we hear, and there'll be some door prizes for people that recognize somebody that's in the room here, or more, one or more people in the room in some younger years. So this connection continued for many years with students of George, and it was with interest that I read in the booklet that was so kindly sent to us ahead of time, how that was, I think, Steve Sargent talking about some of the terms that he and Bert would talk about people being a T1 or a T2, if you had been a direct student of Champ, or if you had been a PhD student of one of Champ's students. So we have a few T2s on that picture. Some of that connection, the one that we are going to talk in more detail, is the working relationship that then Bert developed with George in the later years, where George, after focusing his attention on many projects, decided that it would be good to have a good instrument to measure trace gas concentrations, methane and nitrous oxide. In the pictures here, you can see the original prototype of the trace gas analyzer, and George and Gary Kidd posing there in the lab, that still looks kind of the same mess in the back there right now at Guelph. And then some pictures of this trace gas analyzer, the prototype, in our research trailer. And for those of you, and I don't have a pointer, but
use the mouse.
Oh, right, okay. So for those of you familiar, well, the next slide, you'll see, so the optics is still quite the same, but this was what we used to call the electronics box. So this is what did all the communication between the computer and the TGA, and Bert was very instrumental in getting this to commercial stage, which is the next slide, where the electronics became incorporated into the TGA. And I won't go over the whole principle here of operation, but basically allowed us to do some very detailed measurements on methane, N2O, and several other gases. So this instrument was then sold all over the world, and Bert was, again, very important piece of the puzzle to get people trained in how to use this very sophisticated technology. And I sent a message to Tom Denmead in Australia asking him, you were one of the first, and he said, yes, we were number 13 of the TGA, and he sent me these pictures with quotes, basically saying, I think what Bert was saying right here was something like this, you know. I think it, if you plug it in here, it works, and this is their technician, Gary Miller, that he was working with. So, next slide.
So I'm going to talk for a few minutes. Actually, John Norman scooted me a whole bunch on some things I'd like to say. But for the moment, I'll carry on with our talks here. We feel Bert was very, very strongly influential in developing this TGA system, and the next few slides are going to talk a bit about why the TGA is such an important and useful instrument and some of the work we've done on it, including stuff I did on my PhD with George Thurtle a few years ago. The great thing about this TGA system, one of several great things, was it has excellent flux detection limits for measuring trace gas fluxes down in the nanogram per meter second range. And so that's been really useful in all sorts of studies on trace gas exchange between the surface and the atmosphere, and looking at greenhouse gases and manure management and so forth. There's our flux detection limits if you weren't able to pick that out on your own. So some of the neat things we've been able to do with this analyzer over the years are measure gradients or profiles of concentration at a very fine scale right above the surface of the ground. Here you can see a little trellis system that had profiles, you know, 1 centimeter, 2 centimeters, 4 centimeters, very close to the ground for measuring nitrous oxide flux. And with this system, the resolution was fine enough to detect profiles of nitrous oxide above the soil. And in this case, what we did was run very small microplots of about a meter squared, where one of them had acetylene injected into the ground and the other didn't. And the acetylene inhibits the last stage of denitrification, greatly increasing the nitrous oxide flux, which you can see there. We also have used the system for ammonia measurements, ammonia being one of the most difficult of the agricultural trace gases that people are interested in, being so difficult because it is so sticky. It sticks to tubing, it sticks to the instrument, it has chemical reactions, it's a real nasty one to try to measure. This TGA system, though, is quite well adapted for ammonia, not as far as the laser goes, but in terms of the fact that it can work at very low pressures, and the low pressures help deal with many of the problems with ammonia. And so these are field tests of running the system for ammonia over 3 different treatments of a manure application. And one of them, I guess it would probably be this one, had incorporation of the manure after spreading, while the other ones did not. And you could see a large flux. Other things we've been able to do with the analyzer are use it in a flux gradient mode, which allows us to measure over multiple plots. And these are the equations for flux gradient. And we didn't here include that 1.3 that we sometimes talk about, but I'll refer back to that in a moment. And here you can see the intakes for getting the gradient for N2O. And this system is really great because what we've been able to do is run it round the clock, rain or shine, year in, year out, except for, you know, equipment failures and field operations and maintenance and a few things here and there. But in general, it's been just a fantastic thing, and Clodge has been able to collect many, many years of data. I think the only multi-year data set of continuous N2O fluxes. And so I will pass it back to her to talk about some of that.
Okay, so some of the things that we've been able to figure out is, and this started with my work with George, and then I continued that as a faculty member in the last few years. One of the things we've been able to determine is that non-growing season fluxes can account in cold regions, which definitely Guelph and Ontario are part of that cold region. In those conditions, we can have up to 20 to 80% of the annual flux total occur in those periods. And that's shown here in as the these blue boxes. And spring thaw period is particularly when we get some of these very large emissions. We've also been able to look at different management practices and see that by employing best management practices, which I don't have the time to get into, but there is a significant reduction in emissions. We've also been able to, in recent work, show how models that were thought to work very well for winter conditions actually don't. And that's shown here with the simulated line in pink, showing these large emissions that we don't measure at all. And it relates back to the fundamental mechanism that these models are using to predict what N2O, what this big flush is. So that ice-trapped N2O at depth is not the main mechanism we've been able to show with this work. And that rather, if we think of it, look at the time of year, this is mid-March, where we start getting high temperatures during surface temperatures and rapid snow melt, that this is related, we've been able to relate the N2O flux that varies here with the phase change as measured with heat pulse probes, so that during this phase change period, we have a release of N2O followed by a big peak that we think is microbially mediated. So without getting into the details of all of this, the main point that we wanted to make was how being able to measure very accurately trace gas fluxes has really advanced what we are able to, how we understand these ecosystems, and it's very valuable for climate change studies. So John will take it on from here.
So development of the TGA, of course, has continued. Certainly wouldn't have without Bert's drive and energy to see this happen. An exciting thing that he was very tied up with, he was an author on this paper here, was the development of shifting the TGA into the ability to measure actual isotopes of trace gas species. In this case, we was looking at the 12 CO2 and 13 CO2 isotopes of CO2. And that's really interesting stuff to be able to do, because in photosynthesis, the heavier isotope is discriminated against, and it's discriminated differently in C3 and C4 plants, with corn and soybeans being representative of C3 and C4. So this has enabled a lot of examination into carbon cycling within agroecosystems. I wanted to point out one of the interesting things about this. George commented on the symposium in his honor at Indianapolis, I think it was, that was mentioned earlier, about how this was done because of changes in software as opposed to changes in hardware, that the system was developed in such a way that it could be reprogrammed to look at multiple lines. Work on this continued. There was further modifications to the TGA, producing the TGA-100. Here's work that Tim Griffiths has been doing with the CO2 isotope and using it with eddy covariance measurements. And you'll excuse me. I guess to get back to the Guelph connection, Bert came up in 2005 with Joel and Steve when we were able to purchase a system with money that Claudia received. And we ran our isotope measurements over till and no-till fields and were able to see the changes in decomposition due to the different management practices going on there. And just to get back to that 1.3 I mentioned earlier, one thing that's been so important to me over the years, even though I only see Bert, you know, once a year or so at a conference, it's always been fantastic to be able to sit and talk with him about these issues that John was talking about earlier, energy budget closure, center separation effects. It's hard to imagine not having those conversations anymore with him. But that sort of work has been really important to me, and I hope to carry on with these projects and so we don't have to put 1.3 in that equation anymore. John.
So I just wanted to finish off with some pictures that I got from one of my PhD students. Because I wasn't a PhD student of George, I can't call him a T3, but I would say he's almost a T3 because of my connection to George. And showing them having lunch. And Mario Tenuta, who is a colleague from University of Manitoba, I sent him a message asking for some pictures, and he sent me this big long story saying, you know, he really enjoyed Bert's company and these training sessions that they had when they purchased at TGA, and talking about George being one of his favorite subjects in a very good way, of course. And I'll leave you with some pictures of celebrating the Thurtell-Tanner connection. Thank you.
Another, let's see if I can get your talk up here.